for the week of April 7th, 2019. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 443, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gilt. Sperling, what is this show? What is Showbiz Sandbox? Are we a business podcast or are we an entertainment podcast? Do we provide news or do we provide opinion? I would have to say, really, if you get right down to it, Showbiz Sandbox is uncategorizable. Can't be put into a box.
Okay. I would say we're a podcast because that's the category I have to check. When I post each episode, I have to check podcast on our website. Otherwise, it does not flow through to the RSS reader.
And that means people don't find the show wherever they get their podcast.
Correct. So that was my fault.
So if you're wondering why we didn't have a podcast for 3 weeks, somebody said, hey, it's been so long since you've had a show. I'm like, it's just been a week. Sperling's gone. He'll be back. And they're like, oh, great. Little did I realize the podcast had never appeared.
Yeah, now I can tell you that somebody else didn't know that the podcast hadn't appeared because it seemed to have appeared and then it must have, I don't know what happened. I'll be honest. So we apologize for that,
but 2 weeks ago the show appeared last night. Now it's Monday. We're recording another show. Sperling is back from CinemaCon. This one will get posted as soon as possible and people will actually be able to see it. And when they do, what will they hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got 2 weeks of news to catch up on because I've been a bad boy and went on a business trip. You know, wait a second. I should really read these before I actually go over. Anyway, to be specific, I went to CinemaCon, the annual gathering of exhibitors and movie studios. We'll look at the hot topics that dominated the people attending. But first, I want to finish streaming that great new documentary, Our Planet, that dropped on Netflix Friday night. Boy, was that good. I mean, hey, did any movies actually open this weekend? Actually, no, of course they did. Movies like Shazam! Oh, darn it. Shazam! No, Shazam! Anyway, I thought maybe if I said it enough, I'd turn into Shazam, but
no.
Well, those films don't write themselves, you know. But they may have to if the writers and talent agencies don't come to an agreement soon. We've got the latest. Meanwhile, Billboard is embroiled in controversy for saying a hit song wasn't country enough for that genre's chart. What, you know, a banjo isn't country enough for you? Maybe not when it's played by hip-hop artist and person of color Lil Nas X. Michael will weigh in on that one, partner. Get her done! In movie subscription news, two companies continue to lay the groundwork for new plans, but it will take months before we can see what progress they're making. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. Shazam!
Still didn't work. That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from everybody else. You know them, all the outlets we quote here every week. And the number one movie around the world is, in fact, Shazam. Oh, my God, I am a superhero. $155 million on its opening weekend. The movie cost a reported $98 to $100 million. They're saying it's just a smidge under $100 million, which is a bargain in terms of superhero movies. And you know what? It looked like it.
Yeah, that is true.
I mean, that was a cheap looking movie.
There were moments during that film where I literally kind of went, wait a second, is that like old green screen that they threw in there? Because that looks really bad.
I just mean like the place where our hero goes to find out from the wizard whether he should become a superhero. It just looked like a $10 set made out of paper mache with, you know, evil creatures trapped in stone where their eyes glow red. It just all looked very, very, very low budget. I wasn't a big fan of the film. I thought, you know, some of the actors were fine. The sidekick, Freddy, was good. I thought, what's his name? The lead. Zachary Levi was fine as the adult Shazam. Every once in a while, I hit that sort of sweet spot of big, the idea of a kid being a superhero and the fun that would be. But most of the time, it's just a kind of a muddled mess. It's harmless, but certainly not good. But
if you saw the trailer, you pretty much saw the movie.
Yeah, and it made a good amount of money. You know, a good solid start to the movie. It's going to be profitable, no doubt about that. $155 million on its opening weekend. The same may not be true for Dumbo, which has fallen hard in its second weekend. $57 million worldwide. It's at $213 million. It cost $170 million to make. It'll probably get close to, you know, $500 million, but it's certainly not going to be a slam dunk winner. As with a lot of Tim Burton movies, they look good in the trailer, and then you see the actual film, not so good.
Yeah, well, especially when it's 2 hours long.
Well, and the original animated film was like 63 minutes long. It barely qualifies as a feature film.
Yeah, true.
At number three is Pet Sematary. That movie grossed $42 million on its opening weekend. That's a remake of a Stephen King novel that was turned into a film a couple decades ago. Apparently, we'll be seeing them for the rest of time, just like Shakespeare. At number four is Pea Storm, which is not the Donald Trump story. This is a Hong Kong thriller about a police investigator going undercover in prison. It's the fourth in a franchise. They are Z-Storm, followed by S-Storm, followed by L-Storm, followed by P-Storm, which means the next one could be anybody's guess. I mean, yeah. The clearly alphabetical is not the strong suit. In fact, the next film has been announced. It's G-Storm. And they're making a new one because this one opened up to $40 million on its opening weekend in China and a few other territories. So this franchise is still going strong.
I can tell you that if I were a development executive in Korea today, right now,
this is
a Hong Kong
film.
Oh,
a Chinese
film. Scratch that. If I was a development executive in Hong Kong, I mean, this is how versatile I am, okay? I can go from Korea to Hong Kong in a split second, and I would make the same decision, not even speaking the language, even without reading the script, I would make the sequel.
Yes, you would have greenlit that puppy already.
Yes, exactly.
I'm sure there's a sequel already in the works for Captain Marvel. That passed the $1 billion mark. This weekend, it made another $26 million.
Well, how could there be a sequel? I mean, in Endgame, they're going to save the world. What more could possibly happen?
I guess the world will be threatened again.
By who? I mean, Thanos, I mean, he can snap his fingers. Whoa, spoiler alert. He can snap his fingers and have half of humanity to disappear. What greater strength could come along? What greater threat could show up to rival that?
I don't know. If I knew the comic books better, I would have an answer.
Okay.
At number six around the world is the Jordan Peele horror flick Us, $25 million this weekend. That's at $217 million worldwide. A huge success story, even if the reviews are not as good as they were for Get Out. At number seven, another hit, 5 Feet Apart. Teens in love who can't touch each other. $7 million on the weekend. It's at $62 million worldwide.
So teenagers, that is also a horror film.
Yeah, that's true. At number eight is Anhedoon. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. It's a Hindi black comedy thriller about a blind pianist caught up in murder. It played in China, in India, was a good hit, solid hit. Now it has opened up in China, and India made a total of $15 million, which is great because it only costs $5 million to make. Now in China on opening weekend, has made another $13 million, so almost doubling the take in India in one weekend. That's at $28 million and counting, thanks to China. A good success story. Comscore kind of dropped the ball here a little bit. Sometimes when a movie plays in one territory and then months later it opens up in another one, they don't pick up the fact that it already has a total box office in one territory. So the numbers here on the Comscore chart, we've updated those to include the money it made in India. It's hard keeping track of box office all over the world, especially when the people are not sending you that information all the time. You know, in India especially, they're not wildly disposed to send their information out worldwide for whatever reason. They just got their own world. They're really dealing with their own market. But as you can see, these movies are now playing in the U.S. all the time. They're playing in China, making good money. So it would behoove them to let people know when they've got big hits on their hands. At number nine, Paramount does not have a big hit with Wonder Park, the animated flick. That's at $60 million worldwide. And at number 10, the movie that hoped to be Green Book 2. It's called The Best of Enemies with Taraji P. Henson. It's another civil rights era story about black and white people coming together. $4.5 million on its very modest opening weekend. Scrolling down the chart for some of the new movies, we've got The Shadow Play. This is a Chinese crime thriller about a cop pursuing the truth. In Chinese, the name is actually more closely probably said as "there's a cloud made from rain in the wind." So in English, they've said, let's just call it Shadow Play. But that's made $5.8 million since it opened up. Unplanned is a movie we didn't talk about. That had a big opening weekend in North America. It's a $6 million budgeted drama, a Christian film It's anti-choice, basically. That's the intent of the movie. It had a big opening weekend. It has fallen hard in its second weekend. It's made about $12 million so far. Vice President Mike Pence complimented the film, said how much he loved it. And 5 minutes later, the official Twitter feed for this movie started to celebrate QAnon, this extremist, far-right, nutty, conspiracy theory sort of website-generating idea about a worldwide pedophile ring that's trying to take down President Trump. I mean, that's a weird backers for this film, but you have to note that it did make a good opening weekend in North America. That certainly won't travel anywhere.
No. I'm surprised it's not going to travel. Yeah, no. No.
And number 16 is down the charts is Birthday, which at first all I could find was a 1977 Azerbaijani musical. But that's not what this is. It turns out it's a Korean weepy family drama. So that opened at $2.3 million. And Hotel Mumbai opened up while we were away last weekend. This is a drama about the real-life terrorist attack at the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel. It stars Dev Patel because he is contractually obliged to star in any English-language film related to India in any way, shape, or form. That's made $9 million since it's opened. It's not doing terribly well and didn't get very good reviews. Scrolling down, Green Book is at $310 million. Bohemian Rhapsody, any minute now, this is going to pass the $900 million mark. That's almost as much money as Captain Marvel, for God's sake. That is unbelievable. That is just a monster, monster hit.
Well, it is the champion.
That's right. And, you know, we had a 2 weeks ago when we were here, you probably haven't heard it yet because that podcast just came out. It was a little comment about how in China, they took out all the references to Freddie Mercury being gay and all the stuff about him having AIDS. They took it all out. They ripped the film to shreds just to get it past the censors in China. I was shocked and outraged. Now I found out how much running time that meant, how much had to be removed to do all that. 3 minutes.
What? How is that even possible?
Because they barely mentioned the fact that he's gay or had AIDS. That's how it's possible.
Oh, okay. I guess we brought a lot to the film then.
Yeah, exactly. And there was another film that's not on the charts, understandably so, but a hit film in any country is interesting. There's a Latvian film called Class Reunion. It's the remake of a Dutch film. So that's kind of interesting. That original version was a big hit in Latvia. Then they remade it. Now it's a big hit. It's had 68,000 admissions after 6 weeks, right behind How to Train Your Dragon 3, which is the big current hit in that territory. It was a huge hit in Estonia in 2016 when it became the most viewed film since that country regained its independence from the Soviet Union. It's the biggest, you know, wall-falling hit in 30 years. And it could have been a bigger hit in Latvia. However, the largest chain in the country refused to screen the film because it was released on premium video on demand before it had a theatrical release. So whether you're in North America or Latvia, theaters and exhibitors really care about having that exclusive window. And they're saying, we don't care what you want. You've got to have an exclusive theatrical run if you want us to support your film.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you don't want to be selling the same thing that you could get for free at home. Or maybe not for free, but, you know, that you could easily get at home.
Yeah, so they try to hold the line in whatever they are anywhere in the world.
Pretty much, yes.
And that's at the box office charts right now. But we do have ongoing talks. Will there be movies in the future? Not if writers can't be paid to do it. There's a big battle going on between the WGA and the talent agencies. And the latest news we had over the weekend?
Well,
talks,
I guess there's...
Talks continue.
Yeah, I was going to say, my pause is only because I don't know what you want me to say. Where do you want me to start?
Oh.
Well, they continue to talk, right? I mean, there's no breakthroughs that have occurred.
Well, they had a breakthrough, you know, according at least as the people said it. They met in a smaller group. They had productive talks. From the WGA's perspective, they felt like the talent agents were finally saying, yes, we hear you. There is an issue to discuss. Because before that, the talent agencies kept saying, you don't know how the business works. This is great for you. Packaging is awesome. You make more money that way. Shut the hell up. You don't know what you're talking about. And now they feel like, yes, finally, the talent agencies are saying, okay, yes, there is an issue. There is something to discuss. We acknowledge that you have a perspective and have some problems that you want to resolve. So that was sort of a breakthrough. They've only added an extra week, but part of the impetus for the breakthrough may have been the fact that they did have a vote, and the WGA's vote said 95% approval by its members. Right?
Well, what is being approved to? A code?
The new code of conduct for talent agents, the stance that they're taking, saying, hey, look, this is what we're going to demand from our talent agencies. You can't do packaging. You can't represent us and the other side of the business. You've got to do all these things, or we're not going to work with you. and most of their members adamantly and strongly supported that. They claim they have a list of dozens of small talent agencies ready to sign on to this new code of conduct. And more impetus for the WGA is the fact that the talent agency Endeavor plans to go public by the end of the year, according to the Wall Street Journal. The WGA says, look, this is another conflict of interest. Quote, it is impossible to reconcile the fundamental purpose of an agency to serve the best interests of its clients with the business of maximizing returns for Wall Street. Either you serve us or you serve somebody else, but you can't serve both.
I would disagree with that. I mean, I get the argument, and I can understand the concern 100%. But ultimately, you can actually maximize revenue for shareholders if you sign the best talent and you get them the highest paying jobs. So, you know, in other words, you could do right by both parties. You could do right by your clients as well. You should, if you are a business, whether you're public or private. And if you are a public company, you can maximize revenue by having the best clients and thus doing right by shareholders. Now, that said, I think it could be very difficult to be a talent agency and be public. I think that's kind of a...
I absolutely wouldn't sign with them because their focus will then be short-term quarterly profits. You cannot maximize profits every single quarter, which is what Wall Street demands.
Right,
and that's
why I
wouldn't do it. The long-term
interest
of your clients. Well, then they can't do both. They absolutely cannot do both. And in fact, an obsession with quarterly profits is what's destroying much of our business community, you know, all throughout the country. This is what the last 40 years have shown of the damage of quarterly obsession with quarterly profits. And if I'm a talent, if I'm a client, if I'm a writer, no, I do not want my talent agency to be public. And I don't want them to be running a production company. And I don't want them to be on the other, you know, serving me and the people that I'm trying to sign up with. It seems like a conflict of interest to me. This is what they're arguing about. This is what the whole fight is over.
And I do think that if talent agents, if this packaging thing comes to an end with talent agents, I think, frankly, we have to look at managers and how they act as producers on some of the talents, some of their own talents' productions.
And that's exactly why the WGA had problems signing up managers and lawyers to be on their side. They're like, are we next?
Yeah. Well, the answer is yes. I mean, obviously, it's the same conflict of interest. It's literally exactly the same.
Well, who's next in subscription services? There's a couple things going on in subscription services. We're just going to touch on this briefly because it's still in the discussion stages, I guess, or in the signing up client stage. But Infinity, MyInfinity, is a subscription service that is making noise. It's got a website where people can sign up and say, let us know when you've got information about your package and what you're offering. It's going to be implemented soon. It's going to launch to the public over Labor Day weekend. Basically, what Infinity is looking to do is offer an umbrella plan. So if they sign up, say, Landmark or some other independent chain to a subscription service, whatever the deal may be, one movie a week, unlimited movie, one movie a day, three movies a month, whatever the deal may be, if you sign up for that, you get a card that will give you access to Landmark. And then maybe Angelica Cinema signs up for it. Then you can go to either one. So as more people that sign up, the more valuable your card is. And instead of just being trapped into like one chain, like your AMC card, you might be able to go to 10 or 20 different chains and have a range of stuff. So there's strength in numbers. That's the argument here. And that's what Infinity is pitching to theater chains right now. And that's what the opposite sort of Atom Tickets is offering to people. They're saying, hey, we'll handle your back room. If you want to offer a subscription plan, just like AMC, and what's the theater chain in Texas, the Dine and Dash one?
Alamo?
Alamo. Yeah. They're offering their own plan. And I thought, yeah, you know, Angelica or Alamo offering a plan, that's nice, but I don't know if I'm going to want to spend a lot of money on that because they don't have as many offerings. You know, AMC has a ton. And Alamo, I thought, I don't know if I would buy one to just that one chain. But if it was 10 or 20 chains, then I might start to think about it. That's why I think the Infinity plan is more appealing to me. But of course, a lot of details have to be worked out, but that's what they were doing at CinemaCon, right? Talking to theater chains and trying to get them interested in signing up.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, could this work? Would this work? Is this a good idea? And one little factoid, which you're obviously very aware of, struck me, is the fact that AMC, Regal, and Cinemark control 50% of the North American market. There are about 41,000 screens. Half of them belong to just three chains. But that means the other half belong to smaller chains and mom and pops.
Yes,
right?
So I know the article you're referring to, it's a Variety article, and I knew these numbers at one point, but they are constantly shifting, constantly changing, so it was nice for Variety to kind of remind us all of how many members of the North America Theater Operators Association, or Theater Operators, Theater Owners Association, have less than 10 screens. Okay, 414 have less than 10 screens.
Right, in fact, 30% of the entire market are chains that have less than 150 screens. That's a third of the entire market. So if Infinity can appeal to them and say, hey, band together, and you can actually be a counterweight to AMC and Regal and Cinemark, and maybe increase and draw more people and sell more popcorn and soda, maybe that'll work. So 30% of the entire market is chains with less than 150 screens. People, I guess, like Angelica and Alamo Drafthouse, including Correct. Mom and Pops.
Well, Alamo Drafthouse would be considered a medium-sized circuit.
How many do they have?
Oh, they've got probably in the 200 range. Oh,
so that 10% of the market is chains with 150 to 300 screens. And then 5% and 3%. But you add it all up, you got 50% of the market is theater chains other than the big three and people with less than 1,000 screens. And a lot of them are less than 150 screens. So that's interesting. There's a lot of small chains around there.
Yes, but it always comes down to maybe not quantity and maybe not size, but where are your theaters located and how much traffic do they drive? So, it's all about location, location, location. You know, if you're in the middle of a big city and you have a high grossing theater, doesn't matter whether that's your only theater, studios want you.
Well, yeah, we know obviously these chains with less than 150 screens in small towns are not pulling the revenue per screen that AMC or Regal is. And in fact, they're probably in an area that's small enough, it's not worthwhile for AMC, Regal, or Cinemark to open up a 10-plex or a 20-plex. There just isn't the audience demand to make those screens worthwhile. They know perfectly well, all right, there's not enough population within 10 miles for this screen to work, and so they don't open up. That's why these smaller chains exist.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm trying to look here, but there's only 3.4% of the NATO membership has between 500 and 999 screens. So that's, between 500 and 1,000. Yeah, there aren't that many players in that range.
Right. You're usually really big or you're small.
Right.
Right. That's why you see the less 150 screens is 30% of the market. That's because those are all the guys scattered at drive-ins, small towns, areas that can support a two-screen hardtop, and yet they don't have enough to make it worthwhile AMC's time to go in and build a 20-screen. It just won't work. So
yes,
that's why they exist.
Well, and this almost could have been part of our CinemaCon coverage during Inside Baseball.
Well, it certainly could have. I thought it was an interesting thing to stand on its own. So Infinity is coming. We're going to hear about it more this summer. They're trying to sign up members and see how lucky they get and see what kind of a splash they make when they announce it. The one thing about them that's interesting is that they're doing what we have said all along is the only way a subscription service can work. You either have to have a deal with the theater chain or be the theater chain itself, like AMC, you have to have a deal with the theater chain and or the movie studios. You just can't do it on your own. There's no way to create a plan that's appealing that you won't lose money on unless you have a deal.
Yeah, and full disclosure, Covergent, the consulting group I work with, is working with Influx Worldwide, who is putting Infinity together. And effectively, they are acting as the technology provider for, that's putting that network together.
Which I didn't know about when I made this a story. So
Correct.
Just letting people know, hey, I thought this was a worthwhile story even before I knew you had any link to it. But we'll have to see how it ends up. We'll also have to see where the song Old Town Road ends up. That's our music section. Well, we've got a major controversy around a hot new song.
Here, let me play a little clip from that song.
And, it's only 2 minutes long, so knock yourself out.
Yeah. So then there's no fair use. Okay, never mind. So let's just talk about it without actually...
10, 20 seconds, you could do it.
I don't actually have it, but...
Okay. You want me to sing it? No.
No.
So this is a hit song. It's by Lil Nas X. He scored a viral hit with the song Old Town Road, a tune that he labels as being part of the country trap genre. He sort of created the genre in his own name. It exploded on the charts. It's in the top 20 right now. It may even be in the top 10 by the time this show gets on the air. And it's a hit. It's a hit all over the place. It's on the Hot 100, breaking into the top 10.
Let's just hear a little bit of it, okay?
Okay.
Let's see. I'm gonna play...
Can't no more. I got the horses in the bag. Horse stock is attached.
Okay, so that's how it starts. Okay, let's go to the middle here. Okay, so now that we've been taken down from every podcasting network, I'd say that's definitely a country song.
Sounds pretty country to me.
But he's talking about horses. He's got the banjo going. He's got a heavy bass line. Did you see the video for this?
Well, which one? But I've seen some of them. I see use video game, content from stuff like with country themes or Western themes.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So Billboard heard this song. Initially, it appeared on the country charts. Then they said, you know what? This song isn't quite country enough for us. And everybody yelled prejudice. They said, it is banjos. It is cowboys. How is this not country enough? And also people point out, you know what? A lot of country music, especially bro country, these young solo male artists have been incorporating a lot of hip hop. And they're still saying that's country. So a lot of angst and discussion has ensued. The New York Times, Rolling Stone, everyone and their mother has weighed in. Lil Nas X, however, has been very polite. He's like, well, when you do something different, people don't always know what to think about it, what to do with it. He was very cool about it. And then he said, however, he released a remix with Billy Ray Cyrus adding vocals as if to say, is that country enough for you? So it's interesting. And the question is, was it a bad call? Sperling, clearly you think yes.
I think yes, what?
It was a bad call of Billboard to say this ain't a country song.
Well, yes, I think that, if you listen to it, it sounds very country when it opens. And it's obviously an attempt to be a country song. So when somebody's reaching out for you to slap their hands and say, yeah, we don't want you to advance the genre at all, thanks, it's just silly.
Yeah, I think it was a bad call, but I don't think it was necessarily a bad call in the sense of bad intention or bad will. It's just really, really hard to figure out what songs go where, and it seems obvious to us, but part of their standard is, does this artist have a history with country music? Is it being played on country radio? And at least up until last week, the song was not getting played on country radio. And this is sort of the crazy new world Billboard and the whole music industry has to deal with. How did this song become a hit?
Via TikTok.
TikTok. And they're like, what the hell is TikTok?
I can tell you what TikTok is. It is the bane of every parent's existence. Because. I hate that damn app because kids are just like addicted to it. They just won't. It's like little tiny snippets of looped video. And it was started as like a lip syncing app. And now people make these little creative lip sync videos or these little tiny videos.
So they're being creative and it's an arts and crafts thing. They're creating something on their own. That's creative.
Yes, but
that's
don't good. Have an attention span longer than a gnat because if you do, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. So putting this song on TikTok and seeding it there led to a lot of people creating funky, fun little short clips set to the music of the song. It's less than 2 minutes overall, and that's how it exploded. Country radio wasn't playing the song. It didn't start on country radio. The guy's not a country artist with any history in country music. It started on an app that they're not even sure they know what the hell it is. So I think in the old days, crossover hits crossing into country or into pop were easier to spot because they began on radio. Radio began to play a Dolly Parton song.
I'm sorry, what the heck is radio?
Right, so that's part of the problem. Where songs are becoming hits, where they're becoming popular, it's changing a lot. And when you're looking at streaming, which is where all the attention is having, people aren't identified as country music listening streamers or pop music. They're just streamers. So there's no way to categorize it. If you could look and see, wow, all these country fans are starting to stream this song, then that would be the same indication as the old days where country radio was starting to play it. And Billboard could say, you know what, looking at who's listening to the song, we better take that into account and say, yeah, this is a country hit. Because, it's got a damn banjo. So if you listen to it, it sure sounds like a country hit. So I think it was a bad missed call. They've said now, we can revisit this decision at any time, and they damn well might do so. I think it'll probably end up on the country charts in like 2 minutes. But it's started a lot of conversation, a lot of interesting talk about genres and how classifying music in general is sort of a way to separate people and divide us into little silos, and it's sort of not natural. We just hear music, we like it, We don't worry about what genre it is. So I think it's an interesting discussion. We got a couple links to some of the better stories about it, including one with Don Flemons, the guy from Carolina Chocolate Drops, who just is a black an art person of color, who just had an album last year sort of reclaiming all these old country and western songs. Because as he points out, like, a lot of cowboys were black. You know, we've been there in this music since day one. And the reason they started separating this music out was because record labels wanted to target different groups that say, okay, these are race records. We'll put these to black people. And this is country music. We'll just do these to white people. You know, so it's sort of a random bit of segregation, and nobody's for that. So he's like, hey, music is music. And when it's good, it's good.
Well, we'll see if you think of any of our stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop are any good, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. When is being the number one show on cable not good news? Well, I guess when you're the number one show on cable with a much smaller audience than you were a few years ago. That's the dilemma facing AMC's The Walking Dead. The zombie show already has a place in TV history as the biggest hit in basic cable history. At its peak, it was duking it out with premium cable's massive hit Game of Thrones and matching primetime networks with audiences in the tens of millions, numbers not seen since the heyday of ER. No more. The season 9 finale was the lowest rated in the show's entire history, hitting 5 million viewers. That's the most on cable this year, though in a few weeks, Game of Thrones will top that by 20 million or so. Nonetheless, it's still number one on basic cable and beats most of premium cable too, not counting sports and news. Last season, the two Walking Dead shows grossed $240 million in ad revenue. They're adding a third show in 2020, along with TV movie starring Rick. Whoever that is, Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Rick, the Sheriff Rick, the lead star of the show.
I know I'm kidding around.
Oh. Well, I think it's a big deal that the show is falling hard in the ratings. When you launch two or three spinoffs and stuff midway through the show when it's at its peak, I would say, you're killing the golden goose. Stop, let it just be a hit. Now that they're doing it while it's fading, I go, you're just squeezing blood out of a turnip. Leave it alone. So they can't win in that sense. But, good God, when audiences are becoming less and less interested in your show, launching another series, TV movies, and all this stuff, it's just not a good sign. And I feel like they really betrayed their audience when they said, hey, Rick is leaving the show. Rick is leaving the show. And they have the big episode, and Rick just goes off and is going to star in TV movies. That was such a betrayal. Like, if you're going to kill someone off or have someone be gone, let them be gone. And to just say, we're going to have TV movies with him. He'll be wandering in some other part of the Walking Dead world. I feel like that was such a betrayal of the audience that it really just makes you not care anymore. So they got another show coming. It's going to star two women. It's going to have a female-centric heroine. That'll make it a little different. But it's The Walking Dead. It's still making a lot of money. And that points out my other fact. I wish to God we had a list of popular TV shows and didn't worry whether they were primetime or cable or basic cable or premium. I'd love to know the fact that this is still one of the biggest shows on basic cable, because I would not have guessed that from the numbers here. 5 million is still tops, not counting news and sports. I wouldn't think so, but apparently it is.
Variety just published an excellent feature story detailing how major theater chains farm out their janitorial work to freelancers who end up working hard and long hours for dreadful pay. Of course, they managed to publish that story right before CinemaCon, so I'm sure NATO really appreciates that. It starts with a husband and wife team who clean an AMC in Santa Monica 7 days a week from midnight to 7 or 8 or 9 a.m., depending on how dirty the theaters are. The wife's pay? $300 a week, or about $5 an hour. When her son died and she wanted a day off to attend his funeral, the kind of common courtesy thing you do when your son dies, they gave her a hard time. Like office buildings and other businesses, companies used to hire people and give them good wages to keep their space clean. It wasn't a great job, but it was a decent one and included employees others could trust. Then they decided to save money by farming it out to cleaning companies who subcontract the work again. And again, so that people who finally do the work are deeply mistreated and everyone above them can keep their hands clean. At the same time, Vice Media Company paid a fine of almost $2 million for consistently paying its female employees less money than male employees doing the same work. Finally, the UK bookstore chain Waterstone responded to an employee petition asking for a livable wage minimum of £9 an hour, or slightly more in central London, by saying, and this is what the company said, they simply can't afford to pay their employees a livable wage. The stores aren't profitable enough. Big deal or big whoop?
Workers of the world unite.
With Waterstone, I would probably say, yeah, no, you know what, guys, they're probably right. They're probably not profitable enough. You know, they're selling books, right? We could get that on Amazon.
Right, but if your business can't pay an employee a livable wage, you don't have a business. You're like, we have a good business. We just have to pay you $1 an hour, so shut up. I want to applaud Variety and Hollywood Reporter, both of whom have been doing really good in-depth investigative pieces like the one Variety did. It's great to see because, you know, you're online. There's a temptation just to go a clickbait. This is a big, serious, meaty story that took some investigative work. So good for them. And I feel like we should have a new section about workers' rights.
Yeah, I mean, basically AMC, Regal, all these big chains, and a lot of smaller ones too, I might add. As the studios began to squeeze them, they looked for cost-cutting measures. One place to cut costs, of course, is employees. One way to cut those employee costs is you start to contract out things that aren't operationally important or significant to you, and that was cleaning the theater. And so they would go to these companies that you're right. I think. You know, it's one of those dirty little secrets, no pun intended.
Well, that's every office building in America has the same dirty secret. You used to have employees that worked for the company. You could trust them to be in your offices, you know, by your desk where your things are. You knew them, you recognized them, and then it became subcontracted and subcontracted out to somebody you don't have any responsibility for, so you don't care what they get paid.
Right. Now, speaking of the UK, that country requires businesses to break down pay and employment by gender. It's not a pretty picture. In the UK music biz, the facts are clear. Women are in the minority practically across the board in the business. And even when they're in the same job doing the same work, women are paid substantially less. That's a little less true in newer companies like Spotify, but they just haven't been around long enough for systemic prejudice to take hold. Give them time, that's what I say. The same is true when looking at the US country business. Here we're looking at artists and songwriters, not industry executives, okay? But the story is the same. Men outnumber women to an extraordinary degree, despite the long history of big country female artists like Dolly Parton and Reba McEntire, not to mention current country superstars like Carrie Underwood and Miranda Lambert. It's enough to make a gal wish for a D-I-V-O-R-C-E. And that, by the way, spells divorce, FYI. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, in the UK, they require companies to provide this information, and that's why we're able to talk about it. And when you look at the actual numbers in the story that we linked to, it's really depressing how significantly fewer women there are and how much less they're getting paid. And, you know, a problem can be staring you in the face and you don't see it. I never would have imagined women were that outnumbered by men in country music in terms of songwriting and recording stars, because so many of the best artists in country music right now are women, some of the ones I like the most, like the ones we mentioned. And so I would have guessed they were close to parity in terms of 50-50. I never would have dreamt men were that dominant. But you know what? Until you get the numbers and the facts spelled out to you, sometimes your own personal preferences or prejudices blind you to what's really going on.
Law & Order Special Victims Unit has just been renewed for a record-breaking 21st season, making it the longest-running drama in U.S. history. Creator Dick Wolf surely didn't take the renewal for granted, since the smash hit Law & Order ended right at 20 seasons, leaving it tied with Gunsmoke for the all-time record. With all the Chicago TV shows and a few others on tap, Wolf looks set to have more hours on the air in primetime than any producer in history, passing a record set by the legendary Aaron Spelling. The Mariska Hargitay-led show airs in more than 150 countries and has produced more than 1,100 episodes. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Obviously, it's a record breaker. I would love to know the info on how much money it's making overseas. Because in the old days, once a show hit 100 or 150 episodes, there wasn't any reason to keep making episodes. You could already strip it. You could already milk it as a library item for as much as possible without any extra benefit for another 10, 20, 30 episodes. So there was no point. Plus, the stars cost more and more and more, though Dick Wolf has something to say about that. So it just didn't make sense. But if you're selling in 150 territories and you're raking a lot of money, then the numbers are different. This is why overseas, you never hear TV networks and studios talking about the money they're making worldwide on TV shows, because they don't want their stars and they don't want people to know how much money they're pulling in. But that's the only reason this show is still going on. I mean, I would love to get those numbers. And finally, Ice-T has been playing a cop for like 19 years. That is mind-blowing to me. Ice-T, for the love of God, he's been playing a cop more longer than he was a hip-hop star. That
Wait,
is just...
didn't he have the song Cop Killer?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, just checking. I guess police officers have been very good to him one way or another.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Aaron Spelling had so much television, was producing so much television, was making so much money that when I was at CAA, and I may have told this story numerous times on this show, but every year, Aaron Spelling would come in and he would bring a check, his commission check, to Creative Artists Agency. And back in the 90s, one of the Lee Gabler, one of the heads of the company at the time, would have every single person in the company standing around. There was kind of like a big courtyard where he would kind of get off the elevator and walk in with this check, and everybody would be cheering him as he walked in. And every year he acted surprised.
What? You're here?
Yeah, yeah, every year. I can't believe you're all here to meet me.
Look how rich I am.
Exactly. And he would come in wearing his little matching, sweatpants and sweatshirt. It was pretty funny. Now, you might hope the Justice Department would look at the fact women are paid less than men when doing the same work, or more likely, better work. Or they might look at the abusive treatment of women by radio programmers who demand a grope or more to play their song. Instead, the Trump administration is turning its attention to, get this, the Academy Awards. The Justice Department sent a letter to the Oscars warning them about changing rules to make it harder for Netflix to compare or compete for a Best Picture statue. They said the Academy should not collude to stymie competitors and warned it to think twice about any changes it may be contemplating. Couldn't they have dropped the hammer when Crash beat out Brokeback Mountain, for Pete's sake? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, and it's just bizarre, and it also shows them clueless as to what the Academy is and who's a member. They said, hey, you can't block competitors. Like, the Academy is not made of film studios. It's made of individuals, actors, directors, writers, executives. You know, it's not made of Warner Brothers and Disney trying to compete with Netflix. It's actually individuals. Plus, it's an award show. You know, it's not about doing business. The idea that the Oscar, you know, is needed for doing business, it affects about 3 or 4 movies a year in terms of potential box office out of the 1,000-plus movies released. So, you know, the Oscars really aren't important in terms of business. So, and it would be like saying the Emmys have to include basic cable in the Emmy Awards. And they didn't for many years until they changed the rules. Or saying the ACE Awards had to include prime time when they were designed just for basic cable. It's an award. It's voluntary. People are members, and they can make the rules be whatever they want. So it's just a bizarre thing for them to be involved in, and their short letter showed they don't even understand what's going on.
Well, right. I mean, ultimately, and I talked to Tim Richards about this over the head of View, who had that open letter to BAFTA, and you know, he was on the, you know, one of the on the board of BAFTA, and he said, "Look, you're breaking your own rules. Like, your rules actually forbid a movie like Roma from winning." Okay, so you just have to create rules that make sense, and you can create any rules you want, but you can't then break the rules. So really, it's not up to the Justice Department to make those rules. It's up to AMPAS to make those rules for the Oscars. Now, if those rules don't make sense, then people might stop paying attention to the Oscars, and then they will have to change those rules.
Right, but it's not a anti-competitive business practice. It's a silly award show.
Correct. A few weeks ago, we said a lot of people had pre-added the debut album by new artist Billie Eilish to their Apple Music streaming service. Pre-adding being like the new pre-ordering, so to speak. Well, they weren't the only ones. Eilish became the youngest artist to top the album charts in the UK, with the 17-year-old beating out Joss Stone by 10 days. It's also number one on Billboard and received glowing reviews. No word yet on how many actual albums she sold, but likely it wasn't that much. With 255 million people worldwide paying for a streaming service, that's clearly where the action is. Is Billie's success a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. You know, it happened very organically, just like Lorde. It felt like she came out of nowhere, but she's had a lot of singles, and they've been very successful and well thought of. And now here comes the album. It's just the new world we're in. You know,
I was gonna say out of nowhere. I mean, she's basically since 2016, she's got like 30 million video views.
But this is her debut. She's got more than that, but this is her debut album.
You know?
It's just that's, you know, not that need to have an album out to be taken seriously as an artist. You need to gain attention with just a single and then another single and then another single. You know, it's back to the way it was in the 50s. It's just everything old is new again.
Yeah. You know, so here I am getting back from CinemaCon. I'm trying to catch up on news, and there's this really cool feature on the New York Times where they interviewed Billie Eilish via like FaceTime, her and her brother, who happens to be her producer and
musical
collaborator. So they interviewed via FaceTime. It was actually very well done, and just kind of seeing this very raw interview where it was just her. You know, normally you read the writing, you know, like the artist will speak to a reporter and then it gets transcribed and then it's put into a feature. This was just really raw and it was really cool. And I was like, oh, I'd like to see her perform. And oh, look, she's performing at Coachella. Too bad I sold my tickets just yesterday.
Oh, well, because you heard Solange wasn't going to be performing.
Oh, is she not performing now?
Yeah, she had to back out. She said major production problems prevent her from taking place.
And those major production problems are that my sister basically tore the roof off the place last year, and there's no way
that
I can top that.
Don't say that.
It's true, though.
All right, moving on.
Well, we know the people attending Broadway shows. We know who they are. Even with family-friendly shows like Wicked and Frozen, not to mention hip shows appealing to teens like Dear Evan Hansen and Be More Chill, the Broadway audience is mostly, well, female, white, older, and rich. But who is attending the shows when they go on the road? The Broadway League just revealed new demographic info for the audiences going to see shows on tour. The results are not encouraging. It turns out that on the road, the audiences for Broadway are even older, whiter, and more female. In fact, a whopping 72% were women, which is way up on the already high 62% figure for Broadway. The average age is 53.7, I'd like to say really young, okay? that's also older than Broadway, by the way. And the audience is so white, they won't even offer a breakdown of how white they are. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It'd be nice to know context, because we only know this year, so I don't know if those numbers from the road are better maybe than they were 10 years ago. Maybe they're younger. Maybe it's not as, you know, but they're so bad, it's hard to believe that it isn't just sort of endemic to the way it's been for a long, long time. And I really would have imagined that cheaper tickets maybe and shows on the road would be able to draw a younger audience and get kids to shows and maybe develop the taste for going to theater and Broadway and stuff like that. So I really would have imagined it'd be younger and less wealthy, maybe a little bit less white, or certainly, you know, not as female, and none of that is true. So I think it's a problem long term. Again, I can't compare it to where it was 5 years or 10 years ago. It'd be great to have those numbers. But just looking at the snapshot today, not good.
Well, I just can't wait to see the musical of Alien.
That's right. Yeah, Ridley Scott saw some high school kids had done a production of Alien, which sounds like a joke from the film Rushmore, but they did. They had this very elaborate production of Alien, and he saw it online and gave it a thumbs up and said it looked really cool and all that sort of thing. And I thought, yeah, now your lawyers know about it and they're going to sue, because you can't just let people put shit like that on. So like Ridley Scott says, way to go. Oh, and my lawyers have just served you with papers.
See that guy behind you? Yeah, you've been served.
Yeah, because studios, they just can't allow people to do that, you know?
Even if they say, look, this is harmless, this is fine, you just don't worry about it. If you don't protect your IP, then
you lose the rights to it. Yeah.
You lose the rights to it, right. In the music industry, every company seems to be nudging its way into everybody else's business, okay? Streaming companies are signing artists, record labels are trying to be managers, ticketing agencies are launching record labels, and so on. Well, maybe the same is happening in the book business. In the last few years, the fastest growing segment has been audiobooks. Now hit audiobook label The Story Factory has teamed up with indie publisher Blackstone, and they have poached three best-selling authors from Penguin Random House, one of the biggest publishers in the world. Name brand talents Steve Hamilton, Reed Farrell Coleman, and Meg Gardner have all been lured away by the people who just put those books on tape. Not publishers, just the audiobook people. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a huge deal. I mean, to lure people away from Penguin Random House, and when you're an audiobook publisher, that's kind of mind-blowing to me. So people aren't getting enough attention from the big conglomerates. These people are smaller houses, and they can say, hey, we can do everything they can do, and we're going to do more because we're going to be focused on you. This is where you're making a lot of your money right now. But the idea that they can poach people from Penguin Random House, that's crazy. So that's really big news, and I think that's going to wake a lot of people up.
A year after a disastrous fire on the set of the film Motherless Brooklyn led to the destruction of a brownstone and the death of firefighter Michael Davidson, the New York City Fire Department has delivered a report on the event. Unlike a lot of industry self-reporting about on-set accidents, this one is detailed and might lead to changes in how filmmakers go about their job. Local fire departments should be informed in advance when film shoots are taking place. They should be informed when alterations are made to the interior or exterior of buildings. Finally, the presence of especially flammable material would also be helpful to judge the dangers present when approaching a fire. Essentially, this means a lot of paperwork for someone and figuring out a system so fire departments can access the info quickly and easily. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. This is why you want outside people to be doing these investigations. Basically, what happened was the firefighters came to a building and they went inside not knowing that there were false walls set up for the film shoot. So they thought they were seeing the room, and in fact, there was fire behind those false walls. And the material was so flammable that so all these different ways of them being confused about what they were facing and what was a wall and what wasn't a wall led to this disaster. And hopefully, if they're better informed, which seems difficult, you know, how you can let everybody know about every single thing going on, but at least the important things. Oh, by the way, if you come into this building, you're going to find a maze, you know, with a lair at the end, you know, whatever. You got to let them know. It seems like a really, you know, it's going to be pain in the neck. It's going to be hard to do. But here's a case where we've actually learned about an accident. We've learned about why the problem happened because of how the firefighters were confused by the false walls and some other stuff, and come up with some possible ways to fix it so it doesn't happen in the future. This is what should happen every single time when you have these on-set accidents. But most of the time it doesn't. We don't even find out what the heck they did wrong. So that's very frustrating. It's nice to know that when outsiders are involved, like the New York City Fire Department, we can get some actual information and maybe help to make sure nobody has to die next time somebody's shooting a movie.
Yeah, and you can hear the New York City Fire Department right behind you right now, in fact.
Yes, there they are.
Yes. That wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, we're going to be talking about CinemaCon and how it affects you. We're talking about the movies that are going to be hitting screens at a theater near you.
Well, we're not going to go through a movie release schedule, but I would
like to
warn the parents with small children. Helen Mirren is in this section, so I want you to just cover your children's ears, because Helen Mirren is going to talk, and she is just a potty mouth.
So. Oh my gosh. She basically, okay, I don't know why you found this so fascinating, but okay, so in case you were wondering, I wanted to ask the first question at the NATO and MPAA press conference after the State of the Industry address. This is what my question was going to be. Okay, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Netflix. Pick any topic. It doesn't matter what you talk about. Okay. Just pick.
Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. So that said, obviously Netflix was on everybody's minds because, you know, the industry barely escaped having a streaming movie win Best Picture. Okay.
Just as television barely escaped for years having a cable show win Best Emmy until it did.
Right. Okay.
And a streaming movie is going to win Best Picture. That will happen.
Yes, absolutely. That said, Helen Mirren came out, and I can't even remember for what movie it was, to be honest, because that kind of overshadowed everything.
She said, I love Netflix, but F Netflix.
Right. She said, you know, I love Netflix, but F Netflix. And it was just, now
and
here's
the thing.
And the
audience rose to their feet as one. Right?
Yeah, here's the thing. So that happened like right at the beginning of this this, I guess it was during the Warner Brothers thing, and she was there to introduce The Good Liar, okay? And so there I am, you know, sitting in the press section of this Warner Brothers presentation, and midway through, I get an alert on my phone, and it's the Hollywood Reporter that has now just posted about this. The thing isn't even over yet.
Oh, of course. Gotta be first.
Unbelievable. So later during the show, I sat next to somebody during the Disney presentation, and I'm not going to say which trade outlet this was, but the reporter for the trade outlet was sitting right to my left, and I could see they already had the headline written and most of the story written with big chunks that were taken out for where they were going to put in the quotes, and it was basically, you know, Alan Horn and, you know, I can't remember who the other person was. I think it was Alan Horn and Kathleen Taff address Disney-Fox merger.
Well, that's how people do business in journalism, and they would have changed it if some new news happened and became, they would change the headline if it was something unexpected, but they get heads up about what's going to be covered, they get some background information, they know what's going to be dealt with, and they're just prepared for the story. It's not like people decide in advance what to say, but that's just, you know, sometimes when you're reporting quickly from an event like this, you just know, all right, you got to go to a press conference for a movie, here are the stars, here's the movie, what the movie's about, how much the budget is, and you're ready to run your story, and you get your quotes from them, and you go. It's not anything scandalous.
Speaking of press conferences for movies, speaking of that, guess what press conference was held over the weekend?
I don't know.
Avengers Endgame. And do you know what reporters asked? So what happens in this movie? We haven't seen it. They did not show the movie to reporters, then invited the entire cast out for a press conference.
Why bother? Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. So anyway, we're at CinemaCon. We are just coming off the biggest year in North American box office history. We're coming off the biggest year in worldwide box office history. What was the mood of exhibitors? Were they happy? Were they uneasy? Were they strutting around thinking, hey, we got it going again, you know, we're doing good? Or,
well, I think they feel like, okay, look, you know, obviously there is strength in numbers, and as you're pointing that out, to some extent, hey, some of that comes from the fact that, yes, movie ticket prices have gone up in certain areas. So
but attendance went up too in North America.
But in this case, attendance went up, which is always good to see. Attendance went up for the 12 to 24 range, which is really good to see. So that's a good figure. And I think the real concern is about consolidation. Consolidation on the studio side and consolidation on the exhibitor side. You know, all of these chains are, of course, consolidating. And there's concern about, well, gee, is my circuit going to be soaked up by a Regal or an AMC or a Cineworld or a Cinemark? And then, of course, that just means fewer jobs for everyone along the way. There wasn't as much apprehension, so to speak, about streaming. Certainly, people really feel like, hey, you know what, Netflix, you're welcome to show your movie in our movie theater, but we want it exclusively for a period of time, and we're not talking about 2 weeks.
Well, I mean, again, why weren't they standing around going, damn you, HBO? I mean, Netflix is not in the movie cinema game. Why do they care that much? You know, if Netflix competes for an Oscar, that does not really affect the business in terms of business. But ignore the Oscars. Just as a business, are they sitting around all day going, oh, that damn HBO with Game of Thrones, how dare they? I hate them. They're ruining our business. They have nothing to do with your business. Netflix is in the business of creating content that generally appears only on its streaming service. Once in a while, they release something in theaters. And so what? If they do and you want to show it and you want to make some money, great. If not, what do you care? Why do you care?
Well, then I guess
they're a competitor in terms of video games are competitors, radio is a competitor, online social media is a competitor, TV is a competitor, reading is a competitor, theater is a competitor. I get that, but they're acting like Netflix is somehow eating their babies.
No, only their oldest child.
Right.
No, I mean, ultimately, they're saying, look, you can't be a part of the club if you're not going to play by our rules.
That's fine. Who cares? If you don't want to give us a window, we won't show your movies. End of discussion. Why do you care? Why are they still worried about them? Any more than they're worried about reading, music, and everything else that competes with people's, you know.
Because they're spending $8 billion on content, and even if you have that,
and ABC spending tens of billions of dollars of content on their stuff for ABC and ESPN and the Disney streaming service and all that other stuff.
Yes, but you don't see ESPN showing up and saying, hey, give me a Best Picture Oscar. And
who cares about the Oscars? The Oscars are not, you're a cinema goer, the Oscars are not important in terms of the business. The Oscars are meaningless in terms of the business. Meaningless. Just like the Emmys are meaningless for 99% of TV shows. The Oscars are not important in commercial terms at whatsoever.
I would just like to point out here, if you would like to write to us, the address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com, D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com, and you can address your emails to Michael, M-I-C-H.
They aren't. They aren't important commercially. I just don't understand why Netflix creates such agita for them. There's always a new competitive film, and I don't think that films should take it easy. Oh, we've always withstood everyone. We don't have to bother and stay on top of our game. Of course you do.
Well, in this regard, look, they're taking artists that used to be only available in the cinema.
Well, that ended. It's not just Netflix, and that ended ages ago.
Oh, I agree with that.
Come on, it's that's not Netflix.
And, yeah. And they're putting them in feature films. So now it's not a series. Okay, it's not like Matthew McConaughey going to star in that true crime thing or whatever the heck.
That was a limited run, 6-episode, 1-season thing, and he was gone. So it's a miniseries. They do that happens in the UK for decades. There are movie stars on TV all over the place, not Netflix. Netflix didn't start that, nor did they innovate it, nor are they the biggest at it.
So yeah, so to answer your question from like 5 minutes ago, what was the mood? It was the only uneasiness was really about consolidation. That was really the uneasiness and release schedule, really. And I don't mean, oh my goodness, there's nothing coming. No.
Wouldn't they feel good about releases? Because it seems like studios are now programming more like a 12-month-a-year calendar.
Well, okay. So let's get down to a brass tacks here. Everybody was waiting for one presentation the entire week. You had, five of the big studios, okay, and I guess, it was five of the big studios. Without Sony, it was four big studios. So you had Sony, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Universal, and Lionsgate.
You didn't have the STX. Biggest studio, Disney.
Disney Fox, was there.
Okay.
Everybody was waiting for Disney Fox. So Disney comes out, Alan Horn starts speaking, and he kind of vaguely addresses they addressed it right up front, we're a big happy family now. We'd like to thank all the wonderful Fox executives like Chris Aronson, who we just fired, and Andrew Cripps, who we just fired. It was like incredibly awkward, really awkward. That really
whatever.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah, so there's a big deal. Whatever, they fired people. Okay,
and then they said, now mind you, I guess let's put this in context. Paramount, Warner Brothers, Paramount hadn't gone yet, but most of these studios that have come before have all brought stars out on stage and made a big hoopla over their releases, right? And they've shown almost everything. They basically have said, here's our release schedule, you get to see footage first, here it all is, okay? Disney comes along and says,
Sony didn't bother to show up.
They're coming back next year, supposedly.
And now two others, Disney and Fox, now combined, and they say...
And they say, here's our brands, okay? So that was the first time anybody had any inkling as to what are they going to do with Fox?
What do you mean?
Are they just going to, they didn't know. Are they just going to fold those films into the Disney label? Are they going to keep 20th Century Fox as its own label like they did with Pixar? Are they going to, and Lucasfilm, by the way, and Marvel? Or are they going to, and so this was the first time where you saw Disney, Pixar, Lucasfilm, Marvel, 20th Century Fox, and Fox Searchlight. They were all different labels. So that was kind of nice to see. Now the question does remain, once they get through all of the Fox content, will they just get rid of the label?
Right.
Other than historians,
the fact that they have one more screen credit ahead of Disney, Disney Pixar, Disney 20th Century Fox, Disney Fox Searchlight, who cares? That's just
So they basically lay out, and they do this every single year. They have this like timeline of like when movies are coming out. And it's a very nice graphic. They are Disney. They know how to do graphics. And they did all the Disney, Pixar, Lucasfilm, and Marvel content. Okay? And it basically filled in the entire year.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it was
40% of the box office.
Well, you have like... you have, well, just wait. You have like something big every 3 weeks, every 4 weeks minimum.
Right.
And then the head of distribution, theatrical distribution, franchise management, and business audience insights, Kathleen Taft, that is her name, she said, and here when we bring in the Fox films, that you know, that literally there was an audible gasp. Like you could hear like the whole room like sucked in air because it just... there was no room on the chart anymore. So yeah. they had like 21 films, and you just said they're 40% of the box office. Well, congratulations, Michael. They showed us exactly 40% of their content. They basically, you know, nothing from Maleficent, nothing from Star Wars. They did show the first couple minutes of Avengers Endgame. They showed the first 17 minutes.
They don't need to.
They literally, I said this before they went on stage. I said, everybody's so excited about this. All they have to do is show that darn slide, the one I'm talking about right now, and say, that's what you're playing over the next year. See ya. We're out.
Yeah.
And that's...
But they're going to have a better relationship with people than that, right? They're not treating them dismissively, or is that how people feel?
The word that was associated with it by more than a few exhibitors was, wow, they really came off as arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I kind of went, oh, wow, okay, all right. And this is not me saying it. It's me kind of going, I could see how you would feel that way. Yes, I understand that you would think that.
Well, it's intimidating when they control the entire budget. You know, when they literally control the schedule.
Other than producing the showreel or the trailers, basically, they didn't do anything. They didn't bring out any talent. They didn't bring out any creatives. They just, there you go. There are the trailers, a few trailers, and here's 17 minutes of Toy Story. And, you know, thanks for coming. And meanwhile, Paramount really kind of pulled out all the stops. They did a great job on their presentation. There are some really good movies coming up.
Well,
Gemini Man. You mentioned that 3D is down.
I did not mention it yet. We haven't covered that. But that was one of the fascinating stats that came out of CinemaCon. 3D collapses at the North American box office. 3D ticket sales amounted to $800 million for the entire year of 2018. That's the lowest total since 2008. It was down 38%. It's about 7% of the entire box office. That is, remember, they were telling us, oh, everything's going to be 3D. Dramas, comedies, Woody Allen movies. It's going to be 50, 60, 78. No one's going to want to see a movie any other way than 3D.
And now, you sound just like the one person who was saying that.
And now it's
Jeffrey Katzenberg.
And now it's right. Not the one person. Lots of people said that. That's not just Katzenberg at all.
Katzenberg was the...
He was the cheerleader, but a lot of people
said
that.
Yeah, he's the one who said Woody Allen. That's why I bring him up.
But a lot of people said that. A lot of theater chains believed that you were going to love paying extra money to see movies with 3D with the glasses. And they were reformatting junk that didn't need to be in 3D and pretending it was 3D so they could charge you extra, and they've killed it off. So it's now way down. And unless a movie is really designed to be seen in 3D, people aren't being tricked into that anymore. And kids hate the glasses. So there you go. We were right all along. But it doesn't mean a movie done well. Avatar, I will see in 3D. And Ang Lee, his new film Gemini Man, was screened at CinemaCon in 3D. It was the only film shown in Eclipse in 3D because that movie was made to be seen in 3D. And here's why.
Well, okay, so he is, as you know, he's a big experimenter. He loves 3D, Life of Pi. He loves high frame rate. Now, one of the things they didn't show, and you might remember the Long Walk of Billy Lynn, or where Billy Lynn.
Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
Yeah. He shot that at 120 frames per second, showed it at 120 frames per second.
No one could see it.
Yeah, it was like hyper real. It just did not work. And you know what? It was an experiment. It just didn't work. He shot this Will Smith movie in high frame rate as well. It was not screened. The footage was not screened in high frame rate. It was screened in 3D, and it looked okay. It stars a present-day Will Smith and a younger Will Smith, you know, and one is trying to kill the other. And so, you know, one of the Will Smiths is all digital. You know, the 3D looked pretty good. Couldn't tell you about the high frame rate because we didn't see it.
But you said it was done in 3D for a particular reason or something, I thought.
No, just that it was shot natively in 3D.
Right. So it wasn't to accommodate some special effects or anything in particular. It's just how he wanted to tell this story.
Right. And he doesn't say, oh, we'll shoot it with 3D in mind. He's like, no, we're shooting it in 3D.
Right. And but this film, unlike his last one, a lot of people will be able to show it in the way he intends it to be seen.
Certainly, there is more equipment out there that can do it, yes.
And the higher frame rate?
The higher frame rate that's going to be difficult. I think it will be available in maybe 100, 200 places, maybe more. Maybe I'm wrong and you know, more equipment was upgraded, but you need a projector that can do it. You need a server that can do it. It's in some high-level houses will have it.
So bringing it back to Netflix at the end, one interesting comment somebody made was about the Martin Scorsese film The Irishman, which Netflix intends to release theatrically. We're not sure what kind of window yet, but there's going to be some kind of window. And the comment was that without the big three chains, if they don't give that 90-day window, they won't have the big three chains. And without them, the biggest, widest launch you could hope for is about 500 screens.
And that's pushing it.
Can you explain that to me? Because if you're looking at half the screens are owned by cinema chains that are less than 300, you know, we got a third of all chains are less than 200 screens, then why the heck can't enough of them be stitched together to get a wide release?
Well, what they're forgetting about is you need the operations in place to actually book 500 screens as a distributor. Netflix does not have a theatrical distribution department. Uh-huh. Okay, so they basically are winging it every single time. And when you're doing that, there are people that would have played Roma, okay? Circuits that would have played Roma that couldn't get a print. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they have to fix that. And maybe they will have it fixed by the time The Irishman is released. That may actually happen. And you know what? I certainly hope it is. But there are, you know, 500 screens. I don't know if there are that many exhibitors willing to play the film, because it does seem like an us versus them mentality right now. And do you want to be the person that says, okay, fine, we'll let you in? There are some, mostly nonprofit, mostly small art houses, that are willing to do it because they know, hey, we're going to be the only people in town where cinephiles can come and see this Martin Scorsese movie. We're going to make a mint. And that's exactly what Landmark did. They made a mint off of
Roma.
Off of Roma, and not from the ticket sales, because of course it's four-walled.
I thought it was four-walled, yeah. But they made a mint off sales, concessions.
Right, exactly.
Right, and so that explains also a lot of the smaller independent chains that aren't dominant are in small towns where there's less demand for a film like Roma or perhaps
exactly.
Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. So I thought that would be another reason.
That's exactly correct. You're absolutely right. So you see a lot of film societies booking Netflix content, iPix. It'll be very interesting to see how they handle it. And I've been in my own mind trying to crack this thing. Do you allow Netflix subscribers into the theaters for half price or something like that? Because, you know, you don't care whether you make any money on the release, but you want to go see it on a big screen. Great. You got to pay half, you know, $5 to go see it on the big screen if you're a Netflix subscriber. But then how do you do that? It becomes an operational nightmare.
Well, anyway, so that CinemaCon happened. Basically coming off the biggest year in box office history, people were basically freaked out about Netflix and scared of Disney.
Scared of Disney, yes. I would say that is correct. And now they're not really talking about Saudi Arabia at all.
Right.
Go figure.
Right. The AMC said, should we build in Saudi Arabia after they dismembered a Washington Post journalist? Yes, we should, because we're doing it for freedom.
Yes.
They basically said, it's important. We have to bring movies to the people of Saudi Arabia. We owe it to them. You know, okay, yeah.
But you know whose films, well, maybe they will be shown there, but certainly not a new film. Director Agnes Varda died at the age of 90. Her films, or any new film, I don't think she has any new films in the pipeline. So, but a long history, a great history of film. She's a filmmaking legend.
Yeah, she's a leading figure and the only prominent woman in the French New Wave. She died of breast cancer. Her big movies are, you know, Cleo from 5 to 7, Vagabond, The Gleaners and I. She was married to Jacques Demy, who did The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. She got an honorary Oscar. And late, just in the last couple of years, she had a nice final big success with the documentary Faces Places, which got an Oscar nomination, making her the oldest nominee in history. So that was kind of cool that she had a final swan song where everybody got to celebrate her work and career. And she certainly felt appreciated at the end, I think. A major figure in film history.
Also passing away, Shelley Lazar, She died at the age of 69.
She was the ticket queen, or as Keith Richards called her, the MF ticket queen, the motherfucking ticket queen. He likes to curse. He must be a friend of Helen Mirren. But she's done it all. She worked at Madison Square Garden. Then she worked at Bill Graham's Presents. Then she went, struck out on her own. Paul McCartney said, if you needed tickets to anything, you went to Shelley. She pioneered premium ticketing and all access passes. She said, hey, you've got these super fans. Give them a super experience and charge them a super price, right? Better us than the scalpers. You know, so she might be evil in some ways in terms of what she's pioneered in the music industry. But, you know, she began as a public school teacher and one of her students was Chris Rock. And then she's rubbed shoulders with all the big music celebrities. So were you ever familiar with her as an innovator?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And right now she's probably standing at the pearly gates and the person standing there, whose name now, of course,
Peter.
What is it? Saint Peter. Yeah. Is saying, well, I don't know if I should let you
in. I don't see you on the list.
Yeah. Can you get me tickets to BTS? But yeah, I mean, yeah, she was very widely known.
And two people in music died. One just at the beginning of his career in a way, and the other in the late period. One is rapper Nipsey Hussle. Very sad. He died at 33. Grammy-nominated rapper. He had a new baby, a clothing line, a business, and he was shot to death outside his clothing store in Los Angeles. A very sad loss for a real entrepreneur. And Rankin Roger of the Beats, or the English Beat as he was known in the United States, he died at 56. I can't believe he's just 56. Seems like they've been around forever, right? When he was in his early 20s, he was a founding member and voice of the Beat. Along with David Wakeling and others. Their first three albums are all essential. I Just Can't Stop It, Wappin', and Special Beat Service. The first one I ever bought from them was the great compilation What Is Beat? You can find that, I think, on some streaming services. What a bill. He toured the U.S. at one point with the Pretenders and Talking Heads. Kill me now for not being at that show. What a great show that would have been. He spun off the Beat into General Public and Fine Young Cannibals. They just released a new album in January called Public Confidential, which was solid. He's got a memoir due out in the spring. He had a mini stroke followed by a diagnosis of two brain tumors and lung cancer. That's your body just telling you it's done. You're over. But the Beat were a big band, if you don't know them, a major influence on what was known as the two-tone movement in UK. Those were a lot of multiracial bands. They had music that combined ska, Latin, soul, reggae, punk, pop, rock, you name it. Madness, Culture Club, a lot of others came in the wake of the Beat. Very cool group. If you've never heard their music, check it out.
Well, and thank you for checking our show out. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can download us, rate, and review us. And it does help us out when you do that, by the way. When you rate and review us, it helps other people find the show. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us, or really Michael, to talk about whether the Oscars mean anything when it comes to,
box office. They don't. Like, maybe two movies can benefit from the Oscars, commercially.
Well, anyway. Dirt at showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is at Showbiz Sandbox. Or on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can like our page there. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week you'll find me at oldtownroad.com. And no, it's not taken yet.
Okay, I was just going to say, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that not taken domain, ooh, which I'm sure he's running out to register right now, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com? And don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
And as a last little bit of news, Felicity Huffman is pleading guilty in that college cheating scandal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, she paid $15,000 and
got caught red-handed. Yeah, but still, yeah, we're not done with that story yet for sure.